We spend the hour with the head of the EPA's Midwest region on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Deborah Shore was appointed administrator of the six-state Great Lakes region by President Biden in October. And she said at the time that environmental justice and sound science would be guideposts. We will talk about that work and take your questions on environmental priorities as it relates to clean water, air, and land, 800-642-1234. Deborah Shore is regional administrator for Region 5 of the EPA, overseeing environmental protection efforts in Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Minnesota, Ohio, here in Wisconsin, as well as 35 federally recognized tribal nations. Deborah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. I'm delighted to be with you this morning.
Well, now that you've been in the job about 8 months, give or take, what's emerging as your top priorities? What are you laser focused on?
Climate change and advancing equity and justice are the chief priorities of the Biden-Harris administration and of us at EPA.
And those are very large areas. Climate change, of course, and certainly equity. Can you be more specific in terms of climate change? What are you looking at there?
Sure. And let me start by saying that the passage of the bipartisan infrastructure law last fall is a game changer for EPA and for many, many communities throughout Wisconsin and our country because of the significant dollars that will be invested not only in things like lead pipe replacement, but specifically to climate change. There's a program for electric school buses at $5 billion to over the next 5 years put electric school buses in particularly underserved communities and tribes to replace those diesel-using buses, which emit air pollution that is causing respiratory health problems for so many children and the people who work around them. That's just a small piece of what's coming into EPA, but it addresses climate change in terms of air quality and getting some of those diesel buses off the streets.
So air and water there, looking at, just recently on Wednesday regarding water, EPA issuing the health advisories, setting health risk thresholds for some PFAS compounds to near zero. How much do you expect these advisories to reshape what happens at businesses, manufacturers, or how, you know, people trust their drinking water?
Certainly, and thank you for noting that last Wednesday, EPA did issue an interim health advisory addressing four of the suite of PFAS chemicals. And this is just an advisory. It's not regulatory. It's not enforceable. But the first step is being based on science, giving people information they can use to try to reduce their risk. And the next step is to conduct more research to find out where these PFAS are present in water and in soil at levels above these new advisory levels, and then to work with communities to clean up contamination and to perhaps install filters or technology in public water systems that can filter out these chemicals. There's a lot of funding in the clean water state revolving loan fund, the drinking water revolving loan fund, and separate funding to monitor for these emerging contaminants. So we'll be working with communities, and we already are in Wisconsin with the DNR to provide funding to monitor where these chemicals are and in what concentrations.
Talking with Deborah Shore, the EPA's administrator for Region 5, as we look at PFAS health advisories, you can join in 800-642-1234. Deborah, how will this PFAS health advisories inform the new drinking water standard, setting enforceable standards for these compounds that is expected to, you know, down the pipeline come out of the EPA?
They will. We are continuing to do the scientific research that needs to be the foundation of all of our work in terms of regulation and enforcement. But we think that newer standards may come out next year that will set maximum contaminant levels for some of these PFAS. And in the meantime, we're going to be working with some of the sources of these chemicals to study the quantities and try to restrict their disbursement in the communities and in our environment.
You mentioned the infrastructure law, and the EPA announced $1 billion in grant funding for small and disadvantaged communities dealing with PFAS contamination. What can you tell us about how these funds could help Wisconsin communities in this situation?
Well, communities can apply through their utilities to the state. DNR is the one that dispenses these funds. But we are supporting directly a groundwater research study that DNR is conducting to examine the prevalence of PFAS in shallow groundwater and source tracing. We announced that in February of this year. It's a voluntary municipal water supply sampling effort. As of May, WDNR is investigating 74 locations where PFAS have been confirmed in Wisconsin. And we need to have the data to then inform how we do work going forward.
But if they are forever chemicals, you can't scrub them out of the water supply. Where does the EPA go from here in trying to ensure clean drinking water when you see, like, French Island near La Crosse, about 2,000 residents continue to drink bottled water?
We know that there are technologies available now, granulated carbon reverse osmosis, that can be installed in public water systems that will filter these harmful chemicals out of the water. So first we need to identify the source, then we need to restrict the source insofar as we can. That means if it's coming from an airport where these PFAS were in firefighting foam, many have voluntarily stopped using these firefighting foams, but we need to work with the Defense Department and other sites to restrict these PFAS from entering our air and water and land, and then we need to remediate. There may be ways we can remove some of the contamination, prevent the migration of these PFAS into drinking water sources, but it also may mean installing technologies at either a home filter. There are filters people can put on their own faucets or in the entry of water into their homes, or at the public water supply.
I want to note that the American Chemistry Council, they sent a letter arguing that these health advisories should be subject to interagency review as well as public review and comment due to their wide-reaching implications. The American Chemistry Council, a very powerful trade group. Will the PFAS advisories hold up to the scrutiny?
Well, this is just an advisory. When there is a regulatory measure, such as setting maximum contaminant levels, there will be public comment period. The interim health advisory has been reviewed by the EPA Science Advisory Board, which is going to be issuing a report. I think that we will be following the law, and there is ample opportunity for public comment as we work to develop regulations that are not just a health advisory.
We have the head of the... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Deborah Shore.
Well, I just want to say the EPA feels it's important when we have information that's based on science that allows people to reduce their risk, that we provide that information to the public. And this is based on science, and we feel like it's so important to do our work, which is to protect public health and the environment.
Deborah Shore, head of the EPA's Upper Midwest Region, overseeing protection work in six states, as we talk there about water, PFAS. Join in on hazardous waste cleanup, environmental regulatory issues, manufacturing, your drinking water quality, air quality, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with EPA Regional Administrator Deborah Shore on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. We're in conversation with Region 5 EPA Administrator Deborah Shore. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're touching down on a range of environmental issues. President Biden used $1 billion from the infrastructure law to address legacy pollution and clear a backlog of remediation at Superfund sites. The administration last month directing $7.5 million to tackle cleanup at brownfield sites around Wisconsin. Join in on your EPA-related priorities and questions, 800-642-1234. Deborah Shore, EPA Administrator for the Great Lakes Region, with us for the hour. Deborah, on the topic of brownfield sites, you know, these properties that have hazardous substances, pollutants, contaminants, the EPA saying there are more than 450,000 brownfields in the U.S., could be upwards of 1 million. There isn't that national inventory of them. Can you give us an idea of the scope of this issue here in the Midwest?
Well, one of the reasons, Kate, that Region 5 is the largest of EPA's 10 regions is because we have the industrial history here in the Midwest. And so that this is a center of not only legacy pollution, but vigorous enforcement and robust inspection and a lot of cleanup work that's been done and that is still underway. The good news is we've already seen that where we can engage in remediation and remove contaminated soil and sediments and so on, that these sites then become available for redevelopment. I was just in West Dallas last Wednesday, in fact, touring a brownfield site. Some of it is still undergoing remediation, but there is a major new development right near the farmers market, 400 new apartments, people moving in, and it's so exciting to see, and it's reinvigorating that town, that community, and more to be done, but that's what happens all over the country. We've seen it in Sheboygan and other places where we can do this cleanup.
That is positive, noteworthy, but redevelopment is also complicated by perceived environmental contamination. How do you suggest communities counter the land reuse challenges because of perceived contamination, even when, you know, the environmental contamination has been cleaned up?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think it takes working with communities. One of the things I've learned is how important it is to start with listening and listen to residents and find out what their concerns are. And then you can figure out how to address them. And I think that may mean showing how testing is done, showing how remediation is done, engaging the people who live and work in a community in some of that participatory science. So they may be doing some air testing. We have mobile air monitors and that people can borrow and use to work alongside our inspectors and others to see what the remediated soil quality is. And I think once you have sound information, then you can make better decisions.
Without, though, a national inventory of brownfield sites, how do you know? How do you know what sites to prioritize, how to distribute the funds in the ways that will be most effective for the environment, that will be fair and equitable?
Well, part of the key work of brownfield remediation and what we hear from communities, I was in Muskegon a few weeks ago, is we provide the early money to communities to do site assessments, to do planning that then can attract additional funds from elsewhere to leverage that early EPA investment. I think the communities themselves have the information about which sites have had a legacy, you know, prior industrial sites, tanneries or manufacturers or whatever. So with funding from the EPA, they can determine what kind of contamination is there and what might be needed to clean it up. Among the funds that you announced, EPA had granted to Wisconsin as a $2 million grant to DNR to conduct 22 environmental site assessments, and those will lead to projects themselves.
Talking about the EPA's brownfield remediation efforts with Deborah Shore, the EPA's Region 5 Administrator, you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Deborah, before we move on from brownfields, I just want to discuss brownfields in poorer communities and more diverse communities. You know, when you see that 86% of the communities nationwide selected to receive funding are planning remediation projects in underserved areas, what does that mean to you?
I think, ask what does it mean to the people in those areas who've been living next to contaminated sites. It means the world to them because they no longer will have contaminated soil or air near where they're living. It's improving public health around the country, and all too often we've seen that poorer communities are the ones that bear the brunt of climate change in terms of flooding, and are also where sometimes polluting industries have been located and still are trying to locate.
Let's bring on a caller now. Douglas is with us from Lansing, Iowa. Douglas, go ahead.
Yes, I want to bring up a subject that happened to me years ago. In the 60s, when I was young in high school, we sprayed 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T, the really good, bad Agent Orange, in a program that the Forest Service had across the northern part of the United States to control gooseberries in white pine blister rust areas. And there were hundreds of kids that did this. And I'm near 80 now, and I my health has been perfect. But for years, I tried to get the Forest Service information and asked them what they'd done to monitor this and stuff like that, and they would never even give me a reply. But there were actually hundreds and hundreds of high school kids that worked in the forest. I actually worked in Maine, but I know they did it in Wisconsin, Michigan, all the way across the country. And we spray 2,4-D, 2,4-5-T, the same stuff that they sprayed in Vietnam. And we were doing it in T-shirts, no controls, no nothing. It was kind of interesting because whenever we washed out the spray cans at the end of the day and the streams, when we came back in the morning, the fish were dead.
Douglas, thank you for that. Deborah Shore, what would you say about this pesticide use?
Well, some of the pesticides that were used many years ago are no longer allowed now because we've learned, based on science, that there are harmful effects not only to the target pest, but to the environment at large. DDT is another example. Douglas mentioned this was in the 60s. Fortunately, things are changing. The EPA was established in 1970. And all of this, our growing environmental awareness, has led to aspirational and signature federal legislation like the Clean Water Act in 72 and the Clean Air Act and so on. So our environment is cleaner, better, because we've been working hard for 50 years, but we have so much more to do. And we are studying the effects of other chemicals now on the environment. Mm-hmm. I hope that we are doing better, but in the past, we had many things that we discovered after study were sprayed in ways that were harmful to people as well as other creatures.
Let's pause there with Deborah Shore, EPA Region 5 Administrator. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back after this news update. You're with us for a conversation with the head of the EPA for the six Great Lakes states, Region 5 Administrator Deborah Shore is on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In recent months, the EPA, they rolled out a new iteration of the environmental justice screening and mapping tool to help identify and respond to disparities in pollution impacts and other issues that disproportionately affect communities of color. Join in on the work of the EPA, what you want responded to in your community that hits home to you. 800-642-1234. EPA Region 5 Administrator Deborah Shore with us for the hour. You mentioned at the outset of our conversation that environmental justice and equity is something that you are laser focused on. And I just want to draw attention that it is the public holiday, Juneteenth. And what does environmental justice mean to you in your role at the EPA?
Kate, I like to think about the slogan that many in the disability community use, which is nothing about us without us. And so what that means is going into the communities we serve and listening to what those residents experience, what their lives are entail, and then working with them to try to address historic and systemic issues that may have led to poorer air quality, water quality, and so on. We're learning to do this through developing cumulative health impact assessments. And here in Region 5, we are working on a mechanism to be able to hold workshops throughout the region to assist communities to participate in and to lead the way in those cumulative health impact assessments. Right now, we're working with the City of Chicago Department of Public Health and the Illinois EPA, as well as federal EPA, to develop these workshops and a very thorough cumulative health impact assessment is being done in Chicago, but it was done previously in a area on the southeast side of Chicago that led the city to deny an operating permit to a proposed metal shredding company that was relocating or planning to relocate from a more affluent, largely white neighborhood in Chicago to a black and brown neighborhood that already suffered from significant poorer air quality and so on. So that's just one piece of what we're doing. I can mention several others to try to advance equity and justice. And go ahead.
I just want to bring up that, you know, listening takes time. The public process takes time. Action takes time. How do you affect change when people have lived for too long in extremely unhealthy environments?
Well, the other thing that you will see in this administration is a much more assertive and robust approach to enforcement. based on science and the law. We're also ramping up inspections of existing polluting industries through air and water inspections, and where we find exceedances of the permitted limits, we are taking enforcement action. So it's not solely listening. We're also using every tool we have in our toolbox to try to advance equity and justice and improve the environment.
Connect the dots, then, the EPA publishing its equity action plan earlier this year. How does that inform environmental justice playing out here in the Midwest?
So among the things that the plan says, develop a comprehensive framework for considering cumulative impacts. That's what I just described in doing these assessments and in teaching others how to do them. We're hiring in Region 5 about 5 new full-time employees to work with communities in environmental justice work. We're infusing workforce development in many of our existing programs, such as cleaning up the legacy contaminated sites called areas of concern around the Great Lakes. They're going to be doing more in the way of workforce development for local residents to teach how to restore habitat and construct wetlands and a whole host of things that are part of those remediation programs. And we've issued a guidance from headquarters about using Title VI of the Civil Rights Act in a much more vigorous way than EPA ever has.
Let's talk about Enbridge, the Canadian oil transport company looking to reroute one of its pipelines across Ashland and Iron Counties. You know, the proposed line would go through wetlands near the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa's reservation. What is the EPA's role here in respecting Native American land and treaty rights and working with Enbridge?
The federal EPA is not the permitting agency in terms of that pipeline relocation proposal. However, we did provide very thorough comments on Wisconsin's draft environmental impact statement. And Wisconsin has asked us to work in tandem with them to review that environmental impact statement, which we have done. We think that many of the comments we provided to take climate change into account and to do a much more thorough review of the potential impact on tributaries and on those wetlands will assist in a better review. So that remains to be seen. I know that I visited the Bad River Band about a month ago, and they have globally significant wetland complex in the Ramsar site. And so it's very concerning if there could be a potential spill or rupture that would affect their lands. This administration has pledged and is working with tribes, and I can give you another example from Minnesota in just a minute, but that we respect treaty rights, the ceded treaty rights to hunt fish and gather wild rice are vitally important to the sustenance and cultural history and so on of so many tribal nations. And EPA is committed to working with them to make sure those rights are protected.
And before we move on, you know, Enbridge officials have said that properly maintained pipelines can last indefinitely, but the company's history of spills, especially in Michigan and the Kalamazoo River oil spill, that really challenges that assertion. Is it too risky to keep these pipe, you know, Line 5 in particular, in operation?
you're right that Enbridge, with the pipeline spill in Michigan, that was the largest inland oil spill in American history. We have already seen with another Enbridge line having punctured an aquifer in the north, and Line 5 in places is already 15 years or more past its designed life. So it is extremely concerning about the condition of that line as oil continues to flow through it. Part of what EPA's response is, we're responsible for emergency response when there are spills on land. The Coast Guard is when there are spills in water, but we are looking to do make sure that we are as ready as possible should there be any problems with the pipeline.
Deborah Shore with us, Administrator for Region 5 of the EPA. Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Carol is with us from St. Charles, Illinois. Carol, hi. What is on your mind?
Good morning. Hi, Ms. Shore. I was wondering, are there any, what are the findings of barium deposits on the drinking water supplies? Because apparently they buried them in various locations in barrels, which rusted out. Thank you.
I'm not sure I completely understood Carol's question. Could you repeat it?
Carol has a question about safe barium levels in water supplies, barium being buried. Do you have any insights there?
I do not, but if you want to share my email address with Carol or any of your listeners, I'd be happy to try to respond to her.
Sure. Carol, could you give more information there, or do you have anything else to add?
Well, I would say there are no safe barium levels, but I guess back in the day, I don't know when, if it was 50s, 60s, early 70s, they to get rid of this, probably some type of byproduct barium, they put it in barrels, which they buried and then they rusted. So I will get in touch with her because I know there's been some problems with the drinking water that we switched to one of the Great Lakes from a river supply. So, you know, it's affected, I'm sure, a lot of people, but
Carol,
I will follow
yes,
up.
Thank you. So waste being buried in barrels, those barrels rusting through Deborah Shore and the leakage into drinking water.
No question, that's a problem, and we are seeing it. You mentioned brownfield sites. Some of these are these leaking underground storage tanks, and there is federal money to have those removed and the sites cleaned up when we discover the problem.
EPA's regional administrator for its Region 5 of the country, overseeing environmental protections in 6 Midwest states and 35 tribes. Deborah Shore stays with us. Still time for your questions. Priorities for the EPA, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Administrator Deborah Shore here in the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with EPA Region 5 Administrator Deborah Shore as we explore pressing environmental policy issues that relate to climate change, that relate to Great Lakes water protections, drinking water quality, environmental remediation, air quality, and more. Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Administrator Deborah Shore with us for 9 more minutes. Deborah, our governor, Tony Evers, released a plan for the state to be carbon neutral by 2050. So we now have a clean energy plan, this roadmap, but it requires a lot of cross-collaboration between public and private sector. What would you tell Wisconsin with its plan, and is striving to be carbon neutral enough?
I salute Governor Evers for taking that lead and providing leadership for Wisconsin. We're seeing that happening in cities and states around the country aren't waiting for the federal government. They're saying we need to act, and I think that's terrific. We need to work at every level that we can, individually, in our own lives, in our communities, in our cities and states. And will it be enough? It better be.
Let's turn to the Mississippi River and the EPA providing $1 billion in funding for 10 Mississippi River corridor states going to improve water infrastructure. What are you trying to do on the Mississippi?
We know that there have been and are a number of industries along the Mississippi and power plants and so on that have contributed to contamination and degraded water quality. So, again, those funds will go to investigation, inspection, sampling that will lead to remediation and actions to reduce pollution in the Mississippi.
But how is EPA addressing non-point source pollution, like the stormwater runoff from cities, the agriculture fertilizer from farm fields, the growing plastic pollution? What are you doing there on the Mississippi? Because, you know, we see the significant efforts to address industrial or sewage treatment discharges. But what about these other sources of pollution?
Kate, you're exactly right that non-point sources are a significant contributor to nutrient loading, for instance, in tributaries and leading into the Mississippi. Region 5 is working with Region 7 just across the Mississippi, and we'll be meeting soon with a number of other organizations and states to look at a comprehensive plan to reduce nutrient loading and to work together. We're working with our agriculture partners and farm bureaus to promote practices that reduce nutrient runoff, that lead to healthier soil. It takes a while for our farmers to adopt those practices, but I met with a number of the Yahara group in Wisconsin that is really working hard and leading the way as to how they can deploy a number of things, cover crops and other practices that will reduce nutrient loading.
It's a tricky balance, though, because how does the EPA balance environmental protection with the fact that the Mississippi River is a huge industrial corridor? It is an economic driver. So how do you make that balance between industrial development along the river and protecting water?
I think we've seen over and over where industries can reduce their polluting practices, where water is cleaner, that it enhances economic development. It doesn't serve as a barrier. It serves as a catalyst, frankly. When we can have healthier people and healthier ecosystems, we have healthier economies.
Looking at the EPA's work on the Mississippi River Corridor, in particular with Deborah Shore, EPA's Region 5 Administrator. Still time for your question, 800-642-1234. John is with us from Washburn. John, what would you like to bring up?
Hi, Kate. Hi, Ms. Shore. I'd like to ask her about the plan that Enbridge has, or the EPA has, for cleaning up a potential tar sand oil spill like they had in Kalamazoo. I think the reason that took so long and was so expensive to clean up was that there was no action plan for how to clean up tar sand. So on my farm, if I put a fuel tank in, I have to have a concrete pad, all kinds of plans, and first possible spill. So I'm wondering if the EPA has that.
John, thank you.
we learned a lot through the Kalamazoo spill, John, and it did take a long time because of the extent of that contamination along miles of the Kalamazoo River. But Enbridge spent more than $1 billion to clean that up. We are investing and working on our emergency response capacity should another spill occur. And we may be conducting some joint exercises with the Coast Guard to learn what we can and make sure we're asking all those what-if questions in the event of a spill.
How prepared is the EPA in the event of this type of spill?
Region 5, because of our experience dealing with the Kalamazoo spill, is probably better prepared and more knowledgeable than any other region in terms of our emergency response.
Looking forward, looking ahead here, what is, you know, one issue on your radar that we haven't talked about yet that is absolutely on your plate and we need to be watching and acting on?
Oh, that's a great question. Let me think. We've covered so much in terms of nutrient loading, PFAS, brownfields, and Superfund. I think our challenge now is to take the resources that have been directed our way through the bipartisan infrastructure law and make sure that those funds are spent in a way that's fair and equitable and efficient, and that makes a tangible difference in people's lives. And that's our collective goal. We want to make sure that those lead pipes that are in Illinois and Ohio and our older cities around the Midwest,
Milwaukee,
are replaced. Milwaukee, indeed. So it's really making sure that the resources that have been Congress has allotted are spent well and spent efficiently. We are staffing up in Region 5. Anyone interested should go to usajobs.com because we're posting a lot of those openings, and we are going to make sure that a lot of good work gets done over the next few years.
Deborah, thank you for joining us.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Deborah Shore is EPA's administrator for Region 5. We have a link to EPA's Region 5 site. You can find it at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.